welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we're all back in our respective locations, at least temporary or not. I have to ask, given what's gone on in the last 24 hours, ladies, what are we drinking?
I'm drinking a really large glass of red blend that I put some ice cubes in because I am a very basic late 30s mom. I don't live in the suburbs, but I might as well. Like I had this vision of on Glee when the adorable blonde character on Glee drinks like wine out of a sippy cup. That's my day right now.
Super. Radha, anything good for you?
I'm on approximately my 803rd cup of coffee because I traveled across the country with two small children who now wake up at 4 o'clock saying, "Mommy, wake up. Mommy, wake up." So it's cool.
Yep. Erin?
Right. I had aspirations of buying some sort of like rosé in a can or whatever that White Claw situation is at Whole Foods. And I decided that I just couldn't. So I'm drinking LaCroix, which I consider to be less basic than drinking White Claw. And I don't know if that's true, but that's where we are today. So,
well, the question is, could you really get Wegmans brand LaCroix? Because I'm jonesing for that. And now I've traveled far from Wegmans land.
So it is Sunday. We have a wonderful guest with us here today, Becky Zimmerman. Hi, Becky.
Hi.
We're going to get into lots of things here in just a moment. But we invited Becky on several days ago to talk about Afghanistan. And boy, are we glad that we did, because this has broken wide open in the last 24 hours. So for folks who are listening to this later in the week, things may get run over by events, as is often the case. But bear with us. We're going to do the best we can to piece together what on earth is going on with the Afghanistan negotiations as of Sunday morning. But before we get to that, two things. One, obviously, is the bombshell questions. But two, Becky, you have a new job.
I do have a new job. I'm super excited about it.
You are to be the new editor-in-chief at War on the Rocks. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I start tomorrow.
Well, congratulations. That's going to be very exciting for everyone involved. Best of luck. Let's do some bombshell questions. Lauren, I hope you have them.
I do. If you could pitch a show or series to Netflix, what would it be?
So I think the show that I would pitch would basically be a bunch of people watching and trying to come up with accurate backstories about interesting people who walk past them. I mean, maybe not even accurate backstories. Maybe it could just be fun backstories. But I feel like a reality TV show that's based on people watching, which is one of my favorite activities.
That's pretty good. My husband and I have a theory about this guy that we see when we're sailing that looks as though he kind of lives in a trailer down by the river. But our theory is his name is Benedict something something the third, and is like a massive inheritor of wealth and will soon be in the House of Lords. This has been going on for probably 8 years now. So yeah, there's a lot of potential here.
We are big fans of doing this on airplanes. Yep. Based on the way in which people are behaving. Like on our last flight, there was a guy who was in economy class sitting in front of a lot of children, not just our children, typing and giving angry glances at any noise that happened. And I was like, well, the question is really, is he very important or super very important? Because clearly that email needs to go out.
Has to go out like right now. Okay. What do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
This is a tough one because, like, that's not really my mentality. So my first temptation was to say nothing. There's nothing that I follow like a sport because I don't do the collecting stats and things like that. But then I thought, actually, probably the closest thing to it is cooking and food blogs. So, you know, when I'm deployed, I will go and follow food blogs, even though there's no possibility I'm going to be able to cook anything for months and months. The one magazine I make sure I read every month is Bon Appetit. And I will remember, there was a few months ago, there was this recipe that I swore I was going to make. So in terms of the sort of nerdy cattle, it's the closest I come.
Man, there could be nothing that I follow less like a sport than cooking. I mean that. Like maybe DC new restaurants, kind of, but that's more of a like, oh, I guess we are in NBA playoffs, right? Like it's a, cooking is not a thing I follow like a sport.
I keep a list of DC restaurants to try.
That's just a normal thing to do. Absolutely.
Who is your fictional or literary hero?
So when I was a little girl and I used to say, I'm bored, my mom would kick me out of the house, but my dad would hand me a science fiction book. And in those days, I think I was too young to understand that the male heroes of all of these books were not like me. But yet somehow I intuited, I think, my dad handed me, I don't know if you guys read any Robert Heinlein growing up, but the Heinlein Juveniles series, there is one of them, only one, that has a female protagonist, which is called, I can't believe I'm saying this out loud, it's called Podcane of Mars. So the heroine is a girl named Podcane. And it's a book I still read every few years because it's just a great read. But I think somehow, even though I don't think I realized that it was the first time I was reading a book with a protagonist who was like me, I just gravitated toward it instantly.
Awesome.
I mean, I always identify with Jack Ryan. So, I mean, these are not things that have to be, you know, sensical by any means.
I mean, I don't think I understood that difference. I don't think it would have dawned on me if you had said it, that most heroes were not girls. I don't think I noticed, but I still, that was always my favorite.
All right, last question. Becky, what is your favorite algorithm?
This is such a great question, by the way. My favorite algorithm is, there's this great article from 2012 in the New York Times about Target and their pregnancy predictor algorithm.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you read this? It's an amazing, it's a pretty long article, but it's a great, great article. And the reason why I love it is because my shtick is unintended consequences. And this is a story about Target marketing toward pregnant women, where they actually ended up having to create a second algorithm to disguise the fact that they had gotten so good at predicting when women were pregnant, because they were sending around these ads like, oh, you might want to buy a crib, you might want to buy formula, all these things. And they were freaking people out, you know, to the point that it was, there's in the article, there's a story about a father of a teenage girl who comes in irate that they're marketing baby stuff to his teenage daughter. And then they called him a week later to follow up on it. And he's like, my daughter and I had a little talk. And
as it turns out, amazing.
So they had to come up with a second algorithm to randomize the advertisement slightly so that it didn't look like they were marketing to you because they knew you were pregnant.
Fascinating. All right. So we asked you several days ago to come on to talk about Afghan negotiations. I think you've spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. I think Radha and I both met you the year that we were in Afghanistan. So maybe late 2010, I think, summer 2010, something like that. And you are working for CIVSOC, for the Special Forces folks out there, through RAND. Turns out that was like almost 10 years ago, which I still can't really wrap my head around because I have very vivid deployment memories. Like we said, there's been a lot of news swirling. This weekend, President Trump announced that he had disinvited the Taliban to a trip at Camp David. We're going to get to all of that, but maybe we can just kind of hit the rewind button a week or so ago, because I think what started off this idea or started off this initial phase of conversation was Zalmay Khalilzad, our special representative or sort of lead negotiator with the Taliban, announcing that there was an agreement in principle. And maybe we can just sort of start there if we can. We've covered these negotiations over the last several months at varying intervals. Maybe you can bring us up to speed with what Ambassador Khalilzad thought he had an agreement for maybe 10 days ago or so.
Sure. So the framework agreement, which I think, first of all, it's important to contrast. People in the press keep calling it a peace deal. This is not a peace deal because it is not actually an end to the conflict that's being negotiated. It's essentially the terms for further negotiation in order to end the conflict. So the framework agreement is supposed to have four pillars to it. The first, and they're not necessarily in a particular order, but one of them is CT assurances. So that is that the Taliban will sever ties with Al-Qaeda and perhaps some other groups and somehow guarantee that they won't have safe haven inside Afghanistan. The second one is intra-Afghan negotiations. So that's the sort of peace deal proper to end the war. So the idea that the Afghan people, the Afghan government, will actually enter into direct talks with the Taliban. The third is a ceasefire, some form of reduction in violence that's sort of yet to be specified. And then the fourth is withdrawal of U.S. forces or international forces. And so these are kind of the pieces. The actual details of this have not surprisingly been kept very, very quiet. So I think, you know, I can't speak to the finer points of what's in them, but different parts of the framework agreement are, they vary in their ability to actually be verified.
Right. I mean, and importantly, so these have been discussions that the Americans have had with the Taliban directly, which is interesting on its own front. We've talked a bit about that. The Taliban has refused to negotiate with the Afghan government. And so they've been held kind of at least at arm's length, if not farther afield. They have not participated in these discussions in Doha. And there are a lot of questions about how much they are going to buy into any one of these things. So we have this agreement in principle that Ambassador Khalilzad sort of lays out in front of folks maybe 10 days ago or so. And then last week, and I totally missed this in real time, there was a discussion of actual reduction in U.S. troop presence. And so there was a numbers put forward. We have about 14,000 troops there now. They were going to reduce it to, I forget what, 5,600, something like that, maybe?
Yeah, go down about 5,400, yeah.
Do we know where those numbers came from? It seems like that maybe was the part where the Americans started shifting, you know, that this was something that maybe that the Khalilzad had negotiated but had not been widely circulated elsewhere. Do you have a sense of where the troop number discussion came from or is going?
So my sense has been that the troop numbers themselves are tied, they're not just numbers made up for number's sake, but they're tied to specific sort of missions and basing such that there's a process involved, right? So that it would be like, oh, we're going to leave here and that frees up this many troops, or we're going to continue to do such and such a mission, which means we need this many troops. And so I think that's where the numbers have come from, more so than politically driven.
Okay, so that gets us into, I'm sort of doing this day by day in my head as I tried to piece together what happened. So we have an agreement in principle. We have a floating of a number for U.S. troop reduction, which was really important to the Taliban and getting them on board with sort of moving forward. And then there's been a series of dramatic attacks across Afghanistan and in Kabul in particular. This last Thursday, there was another one of these such attacks that killed two NATO troop members, one from the U.S., one from Romania. That seems to have been important to people, but I've struggled to figure out exactly why. Maybe we can talk, and I know Radha has some questions around civilian casualties more, you know, writ large, but Becky, maybe you can help us sort of understand the Taliban's use of violence as they've participated in these negotiations and how that's played out both for the civilian population, but also the Afghan security forces.
So, I mean, just generally, when we talk about peace processes, it's not unusual to see spikes in violence that happen around key events, like leading up to key events. And I think, you know, it's partly to gain positional advantage, right? To sort of show, a reminder why it is that you want to end this war with us. But I think there's also part of it that's an attempt, it's a sort of a domestic politics argument where it's an attempt to shore up your base to make sure that they don't think you're going to give everything away. So, you know, particularly in the Taliban's case, there's a strong likelihood of splintering to ISIS and other factions. And I think exercising violence from time to time shows that they're not going to be pushovers and, you know, you don't need to splinter to ISIS. We're not going to sell you guys out. And so I think that there's probably some of that involved as well. But yeah, it's been a terrible spike in violence. There have been demonstrations associated with it inside Kabul. It's pretty bad.
And so let me dig into that a little bit, because I think you're right. You're kind of highlighting a tension here, which is there's this use of violence in often that accompanies these types of ceasefire or different types of political settlement negotiations. And there's a little bit of a trade-off. There's this strategic communication end that you're talking about. There's also this question of sort of control and command and control, especially when you have these non-state actor groups, right? So in this case, you have the Taliban taking credit for attacks, and we can come back to that point as well, but attacks that are you know, have some, you know, military fatalities, but actually pretty tremendous civilian death tolls, and not always civilian death tolls in places that are super hostile to the Taliban, right? This isn't like they're just kind of nascent civil war deaths as well. So my question is there anything here that should make us worried about the Taliban's credible ability to reduce violence should a deal be negotiated? Or is this really a Taliban show of force to say, hey, reduce violence?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the big questions that is really difficult for us to answer is how strong is Taliban command and control? It's a moving target. It's a thing that changes over time. And, you know, like the worst thing that could happen would be that we would make a bunch of concessions to get to a deal and then find out when we got to one that the remnants that remain have very little ability to actually speak for any action for the rank and file, and the violence just keeps going. I think that's absolutely something that we need to understand, that we don't understand, quite honestly.
Well, and there's been a lot of turnover in Afghan leadership in these last few years. I mean, it's for anybody who's watched, you know, Taliban politics, you know, going back certainly to 9/11 and even, you know, 1996, you know, the idea that Mullah Baradar is the, you know, lead negotiator is a real blast from the past. So it's, there's some very interesting dynamics going on there. I agree with Radha that this is a huge question.
And I think from what we understand, when the Taliban pass guidance out to their forces, that guidance tends to be obeyed, but it's obeyed perhaps in part because they don't do it that often, right? They have a very light touch compared to what they used to have.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Okay, so we had an agreement in principle, floating of troop numbers, ongoing campaign of violence, and a fairly, not quite spectacular attack, but a very pointed attack in Kabul earlier this week. And then all of a sudden, as we're all enjoying our Saturday evening or afternoon, we have a set of tweets from the president that he has summarily called off a heretofore unknown visit to Camp David by both the Afghan government, President Ashraf Ghani, and the Taliban. And then, of course, Twitter just like loses its mind. I lose my mind. Everybody just sort of like spins. There's a first order question of like, was there actually an invitation? Had it been accepted? There's a whole lot of spin and twirl. And it's, I guess, very indicative of this particular administration that is, when we can debate whether or not that is or is not a good idea, but we first have to assess whether it even ever happened. And that is like a very difficult thing to ascertain.
Absolutely. Yeah. My actually, you know, I kind of in the little Afghan watcher community, the text started going around right after this happened. And, you know, one of my first ones was, do we even know that this is accurate, that this was actually happening? So the Taliban have since responded on Twitter. And based on their responses, it looks like there was supposed to be a trip.
Can I just pause us for 1 second? Because you just said that the Taliban responded on Twitter. I just felt like we should all just take a moment and be like, huh, like definitely 2010 Radha didn't see this coming.
Yes, even the Taliban can join the 21st century. But earlier in the week, maybe it was Friday or earlier on Saturday, Tolo News said that Ashraf Ghani's trip had been postponed. So again, whether there was a Camp David component, I mean, I guess we can sort of say that there are signs point to maybe, and there's certainly enough administration officials talking as if this was a plan on the White House side, regardless of which Afghans ever actually agreed to show up. So there's that.
There seems to have been something in the works. So the one thing I want to insert into our timeline in between these events is that we started to see in the last couple of weeks more public pushback and rumors of pushback against this internally from inside the U.S. government. So in two
quarters, exactly.
One was from Lindsey Graham, who has been a staunch supporter of a really resolute line in Afghanistan. And then the other more increasingly was from Secretary Pompeo, where it was reported that he was refusing to be the actual signature on a deal because he thought we were giving away too much. So just bear in mind that some of this may have factored into the sort of gaming of this tweet on the part of the president. But, you know, these things are so closely held that the group of people that would have known that a trip like this was happening is minuscule. And then the group of people that would have been
objected
to or discussed in any way, that the possibility of making it all public in a tweet is probably a group of one.
Yes, I would agree. I would agree with that. This last point, Becky, actually raises a good question. What do we know, if anything, about the way the terms of this agreement or the overall strategy for negotiations was addressed in the interagency process? There were some articles earlier in the spring about Bolton being sidelined by Khalilzad. You get the impression that there's no love lost there. They, of course, both served in the Bush administration together. You know, is this something that was very, very closely held? And then once DOD and the rest of state and other key actors saw the details, they were like, "Hoo boy, I don't think so." Or is this the case that this was, you know, is this sometimes, you know, it does happen, you know, a very close knit group, you know, that had the president's backing. And there's a lot of suggestion that the president is very keen to have a significant withdrawal before the 2020 election, that, you know, this is just the nature of things. And there should have been then a drive to coordinate this ahead of time, or, you know, ahead of this meeting. I'm just trying to get a sense of what we know about the process, if in fact there was one.
Yeah. So the interagency process is broken, not just on Afghanistan, but, you know, it is not, you know, and I think for most of us, what we remember as the interagency process was what it was in the eighth year of the Obama administration, which is, it couldn't be more different. You're talking about year eight of a very process oriented team and now going to what it is now. But even relative to a regular presidency, the policy process is broken. And so that extends to Afghanistan. With Afghanistan, the construct of the special representative, you know, Ambassador Khalilzad's job, means that you're now operating not just in a regular policy process that is flawed, but you're in a special policy process that's flawed. So the rules are far vaguer about how this is supposed to go and who is supposed to have approval for what. And I think, as I've watched it, that means it's reverting to personality-based kind of talking and politicking.
And posturing, perhaps, even.
To a greater degree than with other policy issues that are facing the administration right now. So when we look at the personalities, you know, Ambassador Khalilzad is notorious for keeping his own counsel and not really consulting or informing people. President of the United States, notorious for basically the same thing. You've got people in this process who are clearly not sharing information with each other, who are making policy by tweets, and that's both the president and Ambassador Khalilzad. So I'm defaulting to the simplest explanation, which is that people don't seem to be talking to each other throughout the process, but then suddenly when there's a document or a tweet or something like that to react to, that's when they're all finding out how each other feels about it. So it's a lot of surprises, not just for the American public, but for everybody in the process as well.
Well, that's, you know, certainly speaks to what we think we know about John Bolton, which is that there's not a lot of process going on at the NSC. So, Becky, you've given us a lot to think about. We're going to have to cut it short there. I think, you know, we could talk about Afghanistan all day, but it turns out the rest of the world is also an omni shambles. And so we have to dig into several other topics here. So thanks so much for joining us and good luck with the new gig at War on the Rocks.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So speaking of omni shambles, shall we shift into keeping up foreign relations and talk about Brexit? I mean, because if you think the Afghan negotiations had a bad few days, that is nothing compared to Boris Johnson's first, you know, full week of parliament with it back in session. Who wants to take a crack at explaining what the foxtrot happened in London this week?
My understanding is, and you guys should correct me as I go along here, that there's a big worry that no deal Brexit is going to happen October 31st, which is when the Brexit deadline will hit, the UK will leave the European Union and European Common Market, but there will not be a deal that explains how anything works after that. And that affects all sorts of things like trade, as well as various intel sharing policies and government policies, transfers, jobs, visas. So it's, you know, messy.
And that new date is October 31st. Correct.
October 31st.
Correct.
What's TBD is whether or not Boris Johnson wants that, or wants it in order to show how hardcore he is for EU negotiators so that they will come back and negotiate.
So Boris Johnson, who is the prime minister of the UK's position, has been that he would rather just leave, even if it's a no deal exit, than continue to extend this.
I think dead in a ditch is the phrase he used.
Yes.
Yeah. No, nobody else agrees with him. And so all of the people, best I can tell, including the Tories, wanted to pass this new law that required the prime minister to request an extension if a deal hadn't been reached by, I believe, October 19th.
Which is like just after some EU summit or whatever.
Right. And Boris Johnson didn't like this deal or this idea. And there was some wrangling, which resulted, failed wrangling, which resulted in a dramatic exit of a number of Tories from the Tory party to other parties, including the Lib Dems, essentially fracturing Boris Johnson's whip and control, and also allowing this law to be passed. So now we have a law that is expected to get the Queen's sign off by October, and that's going to require a change in negotiation strategy. And the Johnson administration is now talking about which parts of the law they could potentially disregard because they claim the law is not well written and appropriate, which itself would produce a court review. So I think that's where we are.
Well, meanwhile.
Yes.
Go ahead, Lauren.
I was going to say, but meanwhile, one of the reasons that Parliament came back all in a twitter to like get this done as soon as humanly possible is because Boris Johnson wanted to prorogue Parliament. Is that how you say it? Such a great word.
Sure.
Yeah.
Cancel. Yeah. He was going to cancel Parliament.
Parliament is canceled for like 5 weeks, basically so that they couldn't thwart him in his endeavors. And there was not really a great way to stop him on this except for, you know, it completely abandoning him, having a vote of no confidence, getting him out of government. But then also, Aaron, maybe you can explain this. He wants to push for elections somewhere in the middle of October because there's not enough shit going on.
Well, because he thinks he would then have a majority. I mean, this is a because the UK does not have a fixed election calendar the way the United States does. The prime minister can really call elections, well, previously, more or less, whenever he or she chose. But now they have this law called the Fixed Term Parliament Act, and it really bit Boris in the ass this week because he then decided that he would try to call for new elections. And while he had a majority, he could not get 2/3 of the members of parliament to agree to call new elections in October. And in particular, Jeremy Corbyn, who I don't usually have very nice things to say about, really saved Britain's bacon on this one by refusing to participate in the call for new elections until the crash out bill got passed. So now that Parliament has signed off on that, the Lords have actually signed off on it, it should go to the Queen. I believe Amanda's article suggests that September 9th is the new date to watch, which is like, I don't know, tomorrow maybe?
Yeah.
To see if new elections get called for there. So by the time this airs, we probably will be in like phase, you know, like 600 news cycles ahead on Brexit. But it's been, you know, for folks, and I don't think any of us were especially complimentary of Theresa May. She did not handle things super well. Like, she really misunderstood the politics of Brexit. She did actually try to negotiate a bill. She took the European, you know, restrictions seriously. She just could never cobble together the parliamentary majority to do it. The entire time, Boris Johnson and sort of the Brexiteers were like, we could do it. It's not that hard. You know, why are you making such a big deal about this? Which frankly feels like, I don't know, everything any man's ever said to me in my job ever. And now these clowns get in there and he is just completely forked on his like first week in office. And I don't know, I guess there's a German word for this, but I took a fair amount of pleasure in watching him just completely get flayed.
I assume that Theresa May is sipping some sherry somewhere. Really enjoyed.
I mean, did you see the pictures of her face like sitting in the back benches?
God.
They were pretty good. So Brexit remains a disaster.
Two of my favorite dynamics going on right now are, one, that even if he managed to do Brexit crash out, no deal, do you know what the first thing they'd have to do immediately after a no deal Brexit?
What?
Negotiate with the EU to figure out how the hell they're going to actually do all this shit. And the second one being that polling in the UK suggests that Jeremy Corbyn is so hated in the United Kingdom that people would rather have a no-deal Brexit, which is actually the worst thing on the planet, than have Jeremy Corbyn as prime minister.
Yikes.
So,
yikes.
Our UK cousins, I wish you the best of luck. If you would like to join the United States, I think that we are looking for new real estate these days. So come on.
Yeah, over. I don't know. We may just all need to move to Canada or something. I have questions.
Yeah.
Any hoodle. Okay. So shifting gears from the UK to former UK territories, do we have a Hong Kong update? It's continued to be quite dramatic over there.
Yes, Carrie Lam has withdrawn the extradition bill that was at the very, very top of the protesters' demands. But she did that and a couple other things that were some minor concessions to the protest movement that's been going on for 14 weeks now, but not in a very satisfactory way to them, and also in a sort of insulting way to them. So I think we should probably expect protests to continue, though it will be interesting to see if they do to the degree of strength that they have over the past several weeks.
Though one of their requests that has been sort of updated from the protesters is an inquiry into police brutality, which she kind of gave a nod to, but has been a sort of ongoing discussion. There are some amazing pictures on Twitter and more generally of efforts to ferry protesters out of some areas when the police there tried to shut down and create choke points to arrest more of the protesters. So it will be particularly interesting to see sort of how the response in some ways creates or doesn't continued momentum for the protests even after concessions.
Outstanding. Well, it seems like maybe we're easing off the brink of what was really some escalating violence, both on the part of the police and some of the protesters. So it'll be interesting to see how those dynamics continue to play out and how the Beijing government, of course, continues to engage one way or the other. Last bit, and keeping up foreign relations, just a drive-by really, was a story that we noticed earlier in the week that there had been a fracturing of the Saudi-UAE coalition in Yemen. And, you know, in a way that's sort of, you know, not that hard to forecast, but I guess the question is only like why it happens now. The Saudis and the Emiratis are now backing disparate Yemeni factions because there's always plenty of Yemeni factions to go around. So that has interesting implications for U.S. politics and U.S. foreign policy here. I have no idea what way this is actually going to go, but it does suggest that things are going to get worse before they get better in Yemen.
That's right.
Great. Glad we got that settled. Okay. So speaking of U.S. foreign policy, let's shift to White House mayhem, which, you know, there was an article in the Washington Post, I don't know, like a week ago, that was basically like, August was Trump's lost month. And it was just about how much of a disaster the month of August has been for the Trump administration and the White House in particular. And I feel like that we're just pushing straight into September with that same narrative. So one of the things that caught our eye, it feels like it happened a month ago, which is often the case around here. Do you all remember when the president tweeted out classified imagery onto Twitter to show that the Iranians had a failed missile or rocket test?
I do. In fact, classified imagery that he potentially took a picture of with his phone?
Yeah.
Or somebody did.
Somebody did.
Took a picture of it with his phone after having crossed out, maybe with a Sharpie, maybe not, the actual classification on the paper.
And so,
that's fun.
This is one of those things, right? Like, it's sort of like, oh my God, that's ridiculous. Can you get a load of this guy? And on the other hand, that is highly classified, like SITK imagery. Like, I need like eyewash. I need like eye bleach. I need to like destroy my computer. I feel like having seen this on the public internets, it is unimaginable to me that is the place where we are. Like, no one stopped him from taking the picture, or whoever else from taking the picture. No one stopped that from going. Like, they're like, this is straight crazy pants.
What's extra crazy about it to me is that, so like the content of the picture is not great, but it's not the end of the world. But he could essentially have had the same effect by degrading the quality of the image just some so that he could share, taunt the Iranians if he wanted to, but not disclose like optical capabilities and analytic techniques in a single tweet. And like, he just couldn't wait the, I don't know, 7 minutes it would have taken to fuzzy up the imagery for release. I mean, I guess my point is just, even if you wanted to tweet this particular content, some of the most like egregious damage that was done by it was just by not having enough patience to wait for a slightly modified version of this.
I don't think Trump would pass the marshmallow test is what I'm saying here.
No. But what's crazy to me is that his intelligence briefers surely know the risk of this and brought in what appeared to be like big posters in order to show him this sort of thing. And nobody said no, which technically the President of the United States is a classification authority. Well, not even technically. President of the United States is a classification authority. If he decides he wants to declassify something and share it with the entire universe, he totally can.
That doesn't make it a good idea.
Right. Legal, but stupid, I believe. Doesn't make it a good idea.
There was some interesting discussion on Twitter about whether what exactly was given away. It's effectively like our ability to take these high quality pictures and what appeared to be suggestions of like what was actually used to do so, whether or not it was a UAV or a satellite. Some people suggested like, look, this is mostly kind of known anyway. It didn't really give away the farm. That doesn't mean you go out and talk about it publicly, in large part because people are going to start to guess, why did you do it? Did you do it on purpose? Did you do it by accident? Did you do it because you're trying to signal something? I mean, the real answer is that the President of the United States has no idea what he is doing, but there will be all kinds of tea leaf reading that is not controllable by the U.S. narrative in China and Russia, Iran, and elsewhere.
I would go even further, though, and to say there's also sort of strategic behavior changes, right? Which is now, what are the ways in which you can manipulate the president into feeling like he needs to demonstrate his like power or to taunt you in order to release sensitive information that you could use later? And it's not like an ideal situation to be in.
No, that's not. Speaking of not ideal situations, it turns out that the administration has repurposed several billion dollars of military construction funds, which we call MILCON dollars, or away from previously agreed upon activities in order to build the wall? Question mark. Is that what happened?
Yeah, more or less. And folks should recall this is not the first time this has happened. This is the second time it's happened in recent months. MILCON is interesting. It's a really small pot of the DoD budget, only about 3% overall, but it is one of the most highly politicized and with the greatest attention from Congress, because those dollars go back to their districts in some way. Not usually in kind of wasteful pork mechanisms, but in building schools for military kids, in, you know, building up facilities.
Upgrades to bases.
There was a lot of hurricane damage in the Carolinas and Florida over the last year that this is going to repair a lot of that. People may remember the tremendous mold damage and other challenges that were going on military housing and a lot of different bases. These funds go to fix or alleviate a lot of those problems. So it was interesting to see DoD's strategy and spreading out the cost across multiple states, across multiple congressional districts, and choosing a lot of, frankly, politically sensitive projects. My question is, did they do this to, as they requested, get that money backfilled in some way? Because they knew that members of Congress would want those done. And like that was going to require new legislation and allow them to backfill that funding. Or did they do it to piss off Congress and get them to push back on the president in some way, which they are?
That's a good question, right? So we're sort of treating DoD budget like a piggy bank because it does not get scrutinized greatly on the congressional side, or at least there are years in which it doesn't. And so it has, one, a huge amount of the discretionary budget to begin with, and two, some money that could be moved around, and you can call some of the work that's going on at the border military construction as well. So you're sort of moving things within accounts. You know, Lauren, to your suggestion, there's an element of Congress did not authorize funds for a construction of the wall at the border. They did authorize all of these other projects with military construction monies. And so now the administration is sort of playing a shell game as an end run around all of that. And look, money moves around the Defense Department all the time. Like, it doesn't get spent exactly the way the appropriators or the authorizers want it to get spent. But this seems particularly pointed. And I think, Lauren, your question is a really good one. Like, is DoD trying to be accommodating, or are they trying to goad Congress into doing something to protect the DoD MILCON interests?
And just one sort of closing thought in this, which is, there is a question sort of on this specific issue on whether they wanted to push back on Congress. But there is this bigger question, which is exactly what you alluded to, Aaron, that the DoD budget and moving between funds under existing authorities is something that really doesn't get scrutinized a lot. And this is not a new thing for the Department of Defense. And it's not clear that that's really the greatest system to operate. There are trade-offs for it, and there are reasons why it has evolved that way. But it certainly is very distinct from, say, if the State Department decide to try to move money between, well, the anything, little money they anywhere. Have between anything and anything else, right? And so I think I guess I'm not optimistic, but it would be great if this actually drove some discussion as to whether this kind of flexibility is A, desirable generally, B, should be limited to the Department of Defense, and C, if so, what kind of oversight should Congress be having on money that they appropriate and authorities that they allow departments and agencies, especially those in the national security apparatus, to operate under. And I think those are kind of open questions that really haven't gotten dealt with and are still pretty outstanding and span multiple administrations now.
Good times. Okay, last topic in White House mayhem. Lauren, I feel you may have some thoughts on this. Erstwhile Secretary of Defense James Mattis has a new book out where he wants to talk about leadership and other things, but definitely not how he feels about the president and whether he is fit to serve, question mark. How are we feeling about what the secretary's book tour and kind of where his commentary tells us, what his commentary tells us about civil military relations and how his tenure at the defense, at the Pentagon has left things?
So a lot of folks know, but just to lay it out there, Secretary Mattis had this book contract before he was nominated to be Secretary of Defense to write a leadership book. He had written some of it, if not much of it, before was actually confirmed as Secretary of Defense. So a lot of this predates his tenure there, and having a general officer go off and write a leadership book that is, you know, kind of boring and fine is fairly normal. To have it released after his tenure as Secretary of Defense, he had an option in this dynamic to say, like, look, I'm going to put this book out, but I'm not going to go on a book tour because I don't want to have commentary about the upcoming election. I don't want to be asked questions about President Trump or other specific decisions in my tenure. And that would be more consistent with the line that he is taking, that he feels he owes a duty of silence to President Trump about decisions that were taken during this administration and how he feels about the president. The lines that he is trying to blur right now is saying that, like, you know, I'm a creature of the Department of Defense and I am apolitical, and therefore I don't talk about politics or things that could be politically construed. What that appears to actually mean is that I don't answer questions that make me feel uncomfortable or embarrassed, because he's more than happy and has been more than happy to talk about politics, to talk about prior administrations, to talk about a current candidate for the president of the United States, Joe Biden, and what he feels about them quite negatively. But he doesn't want to answer questions about a potentially embarrassing situation for him, having worked for President Trump, and does not feel as though having taken a political role, he has a different responsibility to the American people in explaining how this president is or is not equipped to be the president of the United States. The last thing I'll say on this, I feel like I've made a million comments on this in the last 2 weeks, but there are things that Secretary Mattis, only he knows, that only he knows about the president's decision-making, about his capacity to lead, about his ability to face crises. These are elements that Secretary Mattis has a privileged position in, and he swore an oath to the Constitution, not to President Trump. To have him say that he owes a duty of silence to President Trump, to me, shows that he doesn't understand what the fuck he's serving at all.
Well, I would tend to agree. I have a slightly different set of questions, but in terms of what are the other duties, right? I mean, it's sort of the you know, there is a duty of silence, but as you say, Lauren, there's a duty to the Constitution. There's a duty to the American public. More broadly, you know, there's this challenge, I think, about what people consider political, and that somehow the things that go on in the Defense Department are apolitical. And I think that that is deeply astrategic and fundamentally misses the point that whenever you're dealing with strategy, you're making choices. Choices are political. All choices are political. Whether something is worth doing is an inherently political discussion. Whether risks are worth accepting is a political discussion. Whether we should spend money on border walls, aircraft carriers, troop salaries, or, you know, higher education is a political decision. And department officials weigh in on these things all the time, in uniform and out. And so the idea, I mean, I get that he wants to be considered apolitical, that he thought he was being apolitical. But the idea that there is some, you know, mechanistic received word from God on what our threats and strategies and, you know, force structures should be I think the idea that that's revealed wisdom is really damaging and unfortunate.
All of the risks you just said are spot on, but it not only does all of that, it also allows the Department of Defense and the U.S. military to be politicized in a way that Mattis says that he wants to combat against. By pretending as though all of these are apolitical, he has made them a political tool in a way that should be what he is arguably in favor of. Or sorry, not what he is in favor of.
So I think the issue here is that the term political and politicizing is being used in a number of different ways that conflates different ways in which politics inform decision making. One is partisan politics, which
right.
might and probably are inappropriate to drive defense decision making. But the other is general political concerns and political trade-offs that should factor into both military strategy and defense policy. And frankly, we should be concerned if the Department of Defense is making complete decisions completely devoid of considerations of political issues, right? And so I think for the civilian leader of the Department of Defense to say, I should be immune from all political discussions and concerns is frankly concerning and should prompt some follow-up questions in and of itself. So I think I kind of co-sign Lauren's reaction to this, which is, you're obviously happy to talk about things sometimes and not others. And that's really a personal embarrassment effort, not a measured position on what are appropriate and inappropriate influences that relate to political issues.
I think Mattis will continue to be a maddening figure for us and will be a, you know, if not a Rorschach test, then a, I don't know, a foil for many of our thoughts about, you know, how leadership should work, what civil military balance could or should look like, and really what are the duties of the civilian leadership, the political leadership of the department, which is General Mattis's last role as Secretary Mattis, even though he still sees himself, I think, as having 4 stars and wearing a uniform. So can we talk about pop culture for just a minute?
Yeah, what's going on there?
Well, I have 2 things. One, I'm reading a very good book called The Secrets We Kept by Lara Prescott. You guys, I think, would really like it. I'm about halfway through. It is very, very good. It's a spy novel, but sort of a literary spy novel with different narrators and such. So, of course, I'm very into it. It's set in the 1950s. But did you also see the newest announcement of The Crown and the new casting decisions they've made for that?
That Gillian Anderson is going to play Margaret Thatcher.
Amazing. I could not be more excited. I mean, the only thing I'm more excited about is the actual next season of The Crown to come out, which doesn't happen until November. But yes, I think that's, we'd all just want to see her hair, right? I mean, I just want to see like what they do to Gillian Anderson.
Everything.
She'll have better skin than Maggie Thatcher ever had. I mean, that's because clearly she just like bathes in child's blood or something, but I'm looking forward to that. I think it's going to be amazing.
I would just one small pop culture thing to add, which is I had been on the hunt for a non-Apple podcast app and discovered this app, Luminary, and then later heard on Rational Security this recommendation for this podcast called Tabloid, which is, guys, it is amazing. It's all about the making of Ivanka Trump. And it's like, if you want to understand the evolution of this person in a sort of breathless gossip magazine kind of way, like pure, there's no real deep substance that's going to allow you to understand any like policy or decision making. But if you want to understand a certain era of New York with a certain set of people, it's just super well done. I can't.
That is super
delightful.
That is super your shit.
So my shit. But I feel like other people would enjoy it. And it's really delightful.
I will close out pop culture by plugging my my cookbook club, which to take us back to the bombshell questions at the beginning. We pick a cookbook every quarter or so, and a whole bunch of us get together and cook different recipes from it. And it's a good way to test out different things that you otherwise wouldn't make. But our cookbook this month is one of my favorite cookbook authors, Fuchsia Dunlop, with her Szechuan cookbook, Every Grain of Rice. And if you like Szechuan food, it is both a great cookbook, but also just a beautifully written, really good stories, very approachable, doesn't require you to go out and buy a kajillion ingredients that are hard to find. Highly endorse that, but recommend that you, eat carefully and plan your next day carefully when you have it.
sage advice. All right. On that note, I think we are done here. Thanks, ladies. We'll see everyone in a couple weeks.